Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There. The last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers. Available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Have you ever been wrong about a driver?
Yes.
Is there someone who you've axed from the program who, in hindsight, you think, maybe I should have been more patient?
No. A lot of drivers where I thought they could do great, they didn't in the end. Going to Formula One, the pressure is double as much and you have to deliver every lap. So in this pressure, not many could stand.
Helmut Marko, Red Bull Racing Motorsport Advisor, knows what it takes to make it in Formula One and what it takes to win.
If you want to be champion, you're not a gentleman driver. The ego is so big and you have to be like that to win a championship.
He was a racer himself and he still has that mentality.
I'm always the one who is more on the aggressive side. If it comes to decision, should we go more careful? No, go for it.
Hello everyone, I'm Tom Clarkson, and I've wanted to get Helmut Marko on F1 Beyond the Grid for years. Racing's been his life. As a boy at school in Austria, he skied and raced cars with Jochen Rindt, who'd go on to become Formula One world champion. In the early 1970s, Helmut raced in Grand Prix himself and was on the brink of joining Ferrari when a serious eye injury ended his racing career. He shifted gear and became a team owner, and that led him to meet Dietrich Mateschitz, the founder of an energy drink company which sponsored promising young drivers. Dietrich and Helmut saw a chance to start Red Bull Racing, and they took it. The team has achieved the extraordinary since its first Grand Prix in 2005. 6 Constructors' Championships, 8 Drivers' Crowns won by drivers they developed, Sebastian Vettel and Max Verstappen. Helmut credits Max and new team principal Laurent Mekies for the team's return to form during 2025. I talked to Helmut about how Red Bull Racing was born, his role leading the team's young driver program, how he got over the loss of his own racing career, and what makes Vettel and Verstappen so good, and whether he's ever been wrong about a driver. Helmut, thank you for your time. Great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure for me to be here.
There is so much to talk about your life in racing, but can we start with the here and now? All right. You've seen so many great drivers in your life. Is Max Verstappen the best you've ever seen?
It's difficult to say. Different periods, different cars, but he's definitely one of the greatest.
What makes him so good?
He's improving. He's completely focused. And now he's 10 years with us. Nowadays, he doesn't make any difference, mistakes. You know, lap by lap, he's within one tenth. If they tell him the tire, let's say the left one is overheating, okay, within 2 laps, he does the same lap time, but the tire temperature goes down. So he also learns his feeling for the tires, which was, I would say, in 21 a handicap, because in this area, Hamilton was a bit better than him.
Compare now, if you would, the Max Verstappen of today to the Max Verstappen of 2015, when he first came in, age 17.
It's a very mature, still only 28, but very mature. He lost all his winning under all circumstances. It comes now more easy, it comes relaxed. He's far better in his technical feedback, and he develops to a real personality and team leader.
Tell me about, I was going to ask, is he a team leader? Is he someone all the troops want to get behind?
Definitely. And with the success, he got even more confidence, and also he makes comments, and his interviews shows how, I would say, it's a 20 years old body, but the mental strength and the experience and the wisdom is like 40 years old.
You say he's still getting better. Does that mean that 2025 has been his best season, even better than 2023 when he won 19 out of 22 races?
Definitely better. First of all, we didn't have a car which was always in a position of win, but he's more calm. And as I said, he delivers in qualifying. We had been on difficult circuits with the tires. You know, it's also difficult to get the right warm-up, to bring them in the right window. But with him, when it comes to Q3, he delivers.
So Red Bull have had two teams in Formula One for 20 years now. Helmut, can you pick the two best drivers that you've had in that time?
Oh, that's very easy. That's, of course, Max Verstappen and Sebastian Vettel.
Do you think they rub along well together?
No.
Why do you say that?
Because they are a complete different characters. And you know that when Vettel left, we didn't look for a new Vettel. We looked for a new champion. So it's not part of our philosophy to have the driver put in a schedule or in a form. But what makes the difference is, I think, Max is absolutely committed. You know, what I don't understand, after Grand Prix winning, he jumps on his plane and goes in a simulator and makes a E-race, you know. Okay, that's maybe the modern times, but... And also, like Nürburgring with his Ferrari victory, that meant to him so much. And that shows that he's a racer pur.
What made Vettel so good then? You've talked about Max's strengths. What were Vettel's?
Vettel was very, in the beginning already, going in each detail, was sitting with his engineer and... A little bit like Senna, insisting on small details, you know, how much fuel and so on. Where they are similar is the mental strengths. I remember 2013, we were around, I think, 40 points behind Alonso, and we still won the championship.
Was Vettel difficult to control? I'm thinking multi-21 in 2013. I'm thinking of the collision in Turkey 2010.
You know, he was a racer, and if you want to be champion, you are not a gentleman driver. So, of course, the ego is so big, and you have to be like that to win a championship.
Do you genuinely believe what you've just said, that nice guys finish last? It's kind of what you were implying.
I mean, Max is a perfect son-in-law for, I think, every mother. But once he's in the car, he's a different person. And he doesn't have any compromise. He goes for it, look, like he did Imola, his maneuver. And also his overtaking. He's watching the guy and poof, and he overtakes. Some of the other drivers, they try left, they try right, and so on. So his commitment is an absolute one.
How instrumental has he been in the technical turnaround of this car?
Quite massive, but that came together with Laurent. He is a very good engineer. Besides, also that he can work with the people in a very communicative way. And they both, I would say, installed a new way of going into the details, or simply saying the numbers in the simulator is not what matters anymore. It matters what the stopwatch shows. That means to get out the maximum of the car, the driver can rely on it, and it's not on such a small edge that only Max can drive it. So also, if he doesn't have the confidence, he can't go to the limit like he does at the moment.
What is it about the setup that means Max can only drive it? Is it very on edge, this car? I love the analogy that Alex Albon used last year. He said, imagine having your mouse on your computer on super sensitive mode and the cursor is dancing across the screen. Max can handle that, whereas other people can't. Is that a good analogy? Is his feel his greatest strength?
His feel and car control is what makes a difference. You know, we had the car which was very loose in the rear. Checo was lifting, and if you asked Max, I said, well, maybe it's a little bit unstable, but he still was on full throttle.
You mentioned Laurent Mekies just a moment ago, new team principal. How different is the vibe inside the team now compared to how it was before?
We are starting winning again. So the atmosphere, everything is positive. And it's like the old days.
What does Laurent bring that Christian Horner didn't bring?
It's like with a football coach. They all have their different way of leadership. But the main thing is that we are successful again, and both have their merits.
Can we talk about Dietrich Mateschitz now? You knew him incredibly well, obviously. What was he like to work with?
Unfortunately, on the 22nd of October, it was the third anniversary where he died. We all miss him, and asking to work with him was fantastic because he had the vision and decisions were done within minutes. There was no...
Big decision.
For example, when I told him the new contract with Max, which is still going to 28. I mean, there had been quite big numbers in it. And yes, he's the best, he deserves, and we need him. So let's do it.
And Dietrich said?
He said, yes, let's do it.
Straight away.
I didn't make the calculation how much the number would end up, but it's big numbers.
Does the Red Bull Racing program miss Dietrich? You say he made quick decisions, but what else does it miss about Dietrich?
It was always the vision he had. If you explained him, I mean, the story when Newey came, that also meant we had to make big investments financially because our outfit wasn't ready to win a championship. And you explained him, he ask questions, even though he was not at the races, but he still understood what was going on and he supported it.
This episode is sponsored by CarGurus. Buying a car isn't something you do every day, and when the time comes, it's easy to feel overwhelmed by all the options out there. Is this the right car for me? Am I getting a good price or missing out on a better deal somewhere else? Trust me, I've been there. Scrolling endless listings, booking viewings that turn out to be nothing like the photos. It's time-consuming and honestly kind of frustrating. Next time I'm in the market for a new vehicle, I'm starting with CarGurus. They bring everything together in one place. Full specs, service history, price changes, dealer reviews, so you can actually compare like for like without the guesswork. You can search, buy and sell through CarGurus with hundreds of thousands of listings from top-rated dealers across the UK. And here's what really sets them apart. CarGurus is the only site in the UK that shows every deal rating from great to overpriced, so you know exactly where you stand. No pressure, no spin, just the facts. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's CARGURUS.co.uk. CarGurus.co.uk. CarGurus. Search, buy, sell, sorted. This episode is sponsored by Vanta. If you run a business, you'll already know that as your business grows, so does the complexity. More tools, more systems, and before you know it, trying to stay on top of security and compliance feels like a full-time job, and a pretty chaotic one at that. And chaos is not a good strategy where security is concerned. And that's where Vanta comes in. It's like having an AI-powered security expert that's always on, helping you stay ahead of audits, risks, and compliance requirements without the endless manual work. Vanta automates the whole process, monitoring your controls, flagging issues, and giving you one clear place to track everything. It fits right into your existing workflows and scales as you do. So whether you're a startup just taking off or you're already operating at enterprise level like Snowflake, Vanta helps you build a business your customers can actually trust. Get started at vanta.com/grid. That's vanta.com/grid. Let's bring it onto your own racing career now, Helmut. What age were you when you decided you wanted to be a racing driver?
I have to go a little bit back. I was with Jochen Rindt in a boarding school, and he broke by skiing while we should have been at school, but the weather and the snow was fine, but he broke his leg, and our home to the school was about 40 minutes by walking. So he got a plaster, and he owned a factory in Germany. His parents died during the World War attack. So we got a car with a chauffeur, which we sent home after 2 days, said everybody has a license here. Nobody did have a driving license. So it was with these cars, it was always on competition. Everybody could drive, but as long he was fast. When he made a mistake, Chuck, was a change in the drivers. So there came this racing spirit first time up. And then after finishing the high school, Jochen went after a year in racing in Austria to England, was dominant in Formula 2. And so I said I was nearly as fast as him in a VW, which of course is a big difference. But my father said, first you must make, you have to finish your studium, and then you can do what you want. So I got a little break in between. But I was, of course, still good friends with Jochen, was following him in his career. And when I finished, then I started myself.
Was there any racing in your family? Was your father interested?
No. My father was a terrible driver, you know, on the road. My mother was more sportive, but also Jochen, he didn't even know his father because he died when he was 3 months old or so. So it's no racing history in the family, and there was no racing history in Austria. You know, we had hill climb races mainly and some airfields, terrible airfields, which were prepared for a race.
Well, Zeltweg was one, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was the airfield.
Yeah.
And the first Grand Prix with Formula One cars, I think 50% of the cars broke down because the surface, everything was so terrible.
So you were a bit of a rebel, is it fair to say?
Yes.
Going against your parents' wishes, they wanted you to be a lawyer. I'm getting Niki Lauda vibes from you in the way that Niki was a banking family and he rebelled against the family to go racing. Is that a fair comparison, you and Niki?
I think Niki was even braver. He got a credit at the bank where practically his grandfather was the one, if it wouldn't have paid off, would have to pay it, even though he didn't know that at that time, you know. His grandfather was absolutely against racing. So there's similarities.
So where was your first race?
My first race was an airfield race in Vienna in a Formula V car, 67.
Can you remember how it went?
I was a front runner. If I won or finished second or third, I don't know. But what I remember, I made already in the first year money because I sold the car after the season and I was earning some good prize money. It was supported, this Formula V European Championship by VW. So it started quite well.
And was the ambition for you always Formula One? I mean, you were a brilliant sports car racer, but was the ambition always F1?
Sports cars, it was easier, and also saloon cars. We had BMW, we had Porsche, so there were more possibilities. But I went in sports cars. Then, of course, Formula One came into game, yes, and then it was clear the game.
And as you were climbing that ladder, that terrible weekend at Monza in 1970 took place, Jochen lost his life. Did you consider for a moment quitting?
Yes, because at that stage, Jochen was, I wouldn't say a careful driver, but all these times in the Cooper Maserati, where he was driving always over the edge and having quite a few accidents. All that was over, and then this accident, in the end we found out it was some problem with the car, the brake caliber broke or so. It was a big shock, but in the end, then I can tell you, at the funeral in Graz, I got a super offer from a manufacturer. So that's how the times were. And unfortunately, 2-3 people died every year.
How vividly do you remember that weekend? Where were you? Were you at Monza?
No, I was in Austria. There was no TV at that time. It was just on the radio. And Jochen Im, he was born in Germany. He was an Austrian hero. And they stopped everything and said, Jochen Rindt was killed in an accident in Monza. So all Austria was in a shock.
How much did you and Jochen talk about racing? Did he make you a better driver?
Definitely. And there was one project. He was very close with Bernie Ecclestone. And he did racing car shows in Germany and Austria. And they had been financially a big success. And his goal was when he would stop to make it European wide. So, and he knew you need an Austrian driver for that. So he was setting up a Formula 2 team, and the driver should have been Emerson Fittipaldi and me. But all that didn't happen after he died.
God, what a chance that would have been. What made you such a good sports car driver?
In sports car driving, you must find the right, like it is nowadays with the tires. You can't go flat out, because if it is a 6-hour or a 12-hour race, if you go flat out, normally the car wouldn't do it. It's the same if Max would start full throttle or full speed with the tires. After 5 or 6 laps, they will overheat and he would slow down. And in sports car racing, it was similar. You had to make your pace that you can be in front but not break the car.
Well, tell us about your Le Mans victory in 1971. In terms of distance covered, you held the record until 2010. Doesn't sound to me like you were holding back at all.
No, that was a different story. Porsche put, I think, 6 cars on the entry, and more or less all 6 had different specifications. And our car had a Wolfram frame. We didn't know about that. That was stored after the race. Wolfram is a very dangerous material. And I think we had been in the lead after 6 or 7 hours. And second was also a Porsche, but our team was run by Porsche Stuttgart, and the other team was run by John Weyer in England. So, and we were competitors. We were going flat out from this, let's say, 4 or 6 hour till the end, because BA, who was in charge of the whole operation, I told him, listen, we are just 1 lap or 2 laps in front of the Ferrari, and we are going same lap times like qualifying. Couldn't we make range? And he just said, no, the better one may win. So this was the exception from the logical stuff.
How tough was Le Mans back then? Just 2 drivers, you and Gies van Lennep.
It was tough because no power steering, shifting, a clutch like in a truck. So
was it a very heavy clutch?
Very heavy clutch. And, you know, we did nearly 400 on the straights. the car were aerodynamically not very balanced. So I was looking at the flags, in what direction they were going. So, and you adapted and were opposite lock already on the straight, things like that. So,
Hang on. 400 kph, yeah, opposite lock through the Molsheim kink.
Not opposite, but you were steering against the wind, not opposite.
It was
quite an adventure. At that time, I was pretty slim and in good physical shape, and I still lost 3 or 4 kilos.
What an amazing win. What did that win do for you?
That opened me the door for Formula One.
Yeah. With Bonnier.
First Bonnier, then Surtees, and in the end, I ended with BRM.
Let's talk about your Formula One career now. Only the 10 races. It feels, when I read about it, that you were getting quicker and quicker and quicker until we get to the French Grand Prix in 72. Did you feel that you were getting on top of the cars?
At BRM, we had 5 cars. So different chassis, different engines. And the 153 was the old type. I was in this car till Clermont-Ferrand. First time I got the new chassis, I was immediately quickest of the drivers.
You qualified 6th that race.
Yeah, so that was good. But the problem was I was so hungry and crazy to drive this new chassis that the seat fitting didn't. I was 10 centimeters higher than normal, but I wanted to drive the chassis under all circumstances. In a normal chassis or with a proper seat position, the stone wouldn't have hit me. It would have gone above me. But, yeah. And that time was the week before I drove a Ferrari sports car. I was on pole and finished 2nd. And I got an offer for F1.
From?
From Ferrari, yes, it was already.
You'd signed for Ferrari?
No, it was
a letter of intent.
And I should have come to Maranello, because in the end, the old man has to be always involved, and personally, you have to be there and show your audience.
Helmut, so did you deal with Enzo Ferrari himself, or was it Piccinini, or...?
No, it was Peter Shetty, who was a team principal at that time. And I was supposed, after Clermont, to come to Maranello. But I went later on with Niki Lauda. I was helping a little bit him in his negotiations, and there I went down and I saw him first time personally.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that you'd signed for Ferrari. What a great story. Helmut, can you tell us about Clermont in 72? What happened?
I think I had a pretty good start, and it was a fight. Emerson, Ronnie Peterson, and Clermont-Ferrand was a wild circuit, a little bit like Nürburgring. Yeah, and then I saw something coming towards me, and after that, it was unbelievably painful, but I knew it was the first time I had a different version of the 12-cylinder engine, which was using more fuel. So I had more than 200 kilos of fuel on board, and I was 5th or 6th or something like that. And at that time, 20 cars had been behind me. So I knew I had something. If I wanted to survive, at the moment I couldn't see, because automatically both eyes are shut when you hit. Or at that time, the stone was hitting my eye. And so I knew I had something to do. And I was told afterwards, I lifted my arm, parked the car next to the circuit. And then I got a little bit unconscious when Vic Elfer was in the so-called safety car, which was a small Porsche, and which brought me then to a hospital.
Did you know immediately the severity of the situation with your left arm?
I wasn't really aware of what's going on. I just knew that something drastically happened.
So what happened after that? You go to hospital. What did the doctor say?
First of all, we had been in France on a Sunday, on a beautiful Sunday afternoon. First, we went to the normal hospital. They say you have to go to the specialist. We went to the specialist. That took hours. The specialist was at a grill party, And around 8 o'clock, the first time a proper doctor showed up. But, you know, it was not organized like it was nowadays.
Do you think the amount of time it took to be seen made a difference to the eye?
It's difficult to say, but I had a lot of operations. Everything was very painful. If you have ditches in your eye, you can imagine. And then at one night, after 2 or 3 weeks, I noticed it's over, which was difficult because at that time, racing was everything for me. But I said, okay, you have to look forward. Okay.
And did you lose 100% of your vision immediately, or did it
get
worse?
I could see visions, not exactly, but they say if they repair the lens, all that could happen. But in the end, the nerves are very sensible, and if they're not fed by blood, they die relatively quick. So in the end, if I would have been straight away at the right doctor and the right operation, it could have been saved, maybe.
I hope this doesn't sound a very naive question, but did you think you could race on with just your right eye, or is that not possible?
I mean, during the night when I couldn't sleep, I was thinking, yes, we'll try and this and that. But in the end, it doesn't work.
This episode is sponsored by F1 Authentics, the official home of F1 memorabilia. If you've ever wanted to own a real piece of Formula One history, this is your chance. With both a shop and auction, F1 Authentics hosts unrivaled memorabilia straight from the track. We're talking genuine bodywork taken from some of the sport's most iconic cars, racewear worn by F1's biggest stars, and even full-size show cars and motion simulators. Unique items go up for auction all year round, including rare one-of-a-kind signed pieces. The end of season auction is running from November the 18th until December the 7th and features a number of exclusive items from Nico Hülkenberg's special gold leaf Aztec helmet from the 2025 Mexico Grand Prix to a Goodyear tyre from the 1997 season signed by 20 drivers, including multiple world champions. There's something for every kind of fan, whether it's a full XF1 rolling chassis, a show car fit for a gallery, or a piece of race-used bodywork mounted in acrylic for your shelf or office. This is the real deal. You'll find signed pieces from the drivers themselves, including helmets and photographs, which are perfect if you want to celebrate your favourite driver or team and own a piece of their legacy. And they've even created furniture like tables, stools and clocks made from genuine F1 parts. So get your hands on unique F1 items found nowhere else at the official home of F1 memorabilia. With new items added regularly, you can own the moment and become the proud steward of a piece of F1 history. For a limited time, use the code BTGRID10 for an exclusive 10% off your next order. Exclusions apply. Full details, terms and conditions are available on the F1 Authentics website. Find your ultimate piece of F1 memorabilia now by heading over to f1authentics.com. This episode is sponsored by Shopify. You know when you're shopping online and you hit checkout and suddenly there it is, that purple Shop Pay button. You just tap it and everything fills in automatically. In fact, it's so easy, you're done in seconds. Well, that's Shopify. But Shopify doesn't just make it easy to buy things. It's also what makes it incredibly easy to sell things. It's the platform powering 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from huge names like Gymshark and Mattel to brands that are just getting started. And if you are starting something, Shopify's with you from day one, giving you access to hundreds of beautiful ready-made templates to build your online store, no coding required. You can manage inventory, track payments, run email campaigns, and yep, your customers get that same super easy checkout experience too. Because that purple button I mentioned, it's actually the best converting checkout on the planet. If you want to see less carts being abandoned, it's time to head over to Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/beyondthegrid. Go to shopify.com/beyondthegrid. Shopify.com/beyondthegrid. So what happens next? Do you feel a lot of bitterness about what happened, or did you accept it?
First, yes, I feel bitterness, but then I'm a rational guy. So I thought, okay, that's over. I was 28 or so, that's not so old. And yeah, and then I decided, okay, you have to do something different. And I made some investments to like a normal life. But then it came up, I started with own teams in junior categories. I helped Gerhard Berger, made a Formula 3 team for him, and several other stuff, yeah. And a couple of years later, I met first time Mateschitz, and at that time he said, no, my company is young, I can't afford to sponsor motor racing. But he was already sniffing into it, and I could feel there is some big interest. And you know, he's born 50 kilometers away from where I was born. So
did you know him already, Dietrich?
Not when I was racing. No. When I had my teams, I knew him. And yeah, so we stayed in contact, and then we decided to make the Red Bull Junior team. It was him, he was a fan, he knew how expensive racing is. So we just sponsored to help young drivers. And pretty soon we had two Formula One teams, so we changed our approach and said we don't sponsor anymore everybody. Now we only sponsor people who can win at least a Grand Prix.
It changed very quickly. Helmut, don't be modest. If you hadn't met Dietrich, would Red Bull be in Formula One?
It's difficult to say, but we had the same approach, the same enthusiasm for the motor racing, and maybe he wouldn't have had or Red Bull wouldn't have to or would have owned teams themselves. I mean, Dietrich was 10 years majority shareholders at Sauber, but without any voting rights, and it came through Klien. Klien was a young Austrian, and we bought him a seat at Jaguar. And during these negotiations, I got the feeling, hey, we could do more. And then in the end, after half a year of negotiations, we got the team more or less for $1. But we did invest a lot. And there his words were, let's try it. Maybe we win a Grand Prix once.
So let's win a Grand Prix once with our own team. Why did you think you needed two teams? Getting greedy.
There was so much enthusiasm. Yeah. And it was also relatively cheap, and the team was very critical financially.
We're talking about Minardi. Yeah.
Minardi. So, and it wasn't logical, let's put it like that.
And the job was that Toro Rosso, as it was then, was to develop young talent, and then Red Bull Racing was to win the races.
No, that
was... Is that the split?
That came later. In the beginning, Gerhard Berger became 50% shareholders in a very funny deal that happened once in the evening or so. And Dietrich got 50% of his transport company. So at that time, I think we had Cosworth engines, and Toro also had Ferrari engines, which was the better and the stronger engine. And there was Vettel, which was a big fight with BMW to get him. In the end, we succeeded. And then Vettel won Monza. You know,
That went against the script.
Yeah. So immediately, Gerhard is a very competitive person. He didn't want to be number two. So now the fight was between Toro Rosso and Red Bull Racing for Vettel, where Red Bull Racing succeeded. And
is that why Gerhard left Toro Rosso? Because he didn't want to be the number two?
That was one part, and also he couldn't find the necessary sponsorship, so he had to put his own money into the team, which is not really what Gerhard wanted, you know.
Look, you've talked a lot about the Young Driver Program. Can I ask you this? Have you ever been wrong about a driver?
Yes.
Is there someone who you've axed from the program who, in hindsight, you think, maybe I should have been more patient?
No, that's not the case, but it was the opposite. A lot of drivers where I thought they could do great, they didn't in the end. And that was mainly, most of them, Lini all had the talent, but they were not seriously working, or they hadn't the mental strength, which is necessary, because they believe once they are from Formula 2 going to Formula 1, someone is carrying their helmet and their life is nice. But it's opposite. The pressure is double as much and you have to deliver every lap. So in this pressure, not many could stand.
There's the perception that you're quite hard on the young guys, these teenagers who are still sort of developing, their brains are still developing. Do you ever have a phone conversation with one of them where you think, perhaps I was a bit hard?
It's always hard if you tell to them that the Formula One program is stopped or they won't make it. But we made a statistic, more than 95% of the drivers which we had in the program and didn't make it to Formula One are racing in Formula E, in sports cars or whatsoever. They earn more money than they would be in a normal job, and they do what they like. So in the end, everybody should be thankful that it was in our program.
That's a good point. So that they are professional racing drivers.
Professional racing.
Is there anyone who slipped through your fingers, who you wanted to have but didn't? And I remember Bruno Michel telling me that Robert Kubica slipped through his fingers, and he still thinks about it today, saying, how did I let him go? Is there anyone that you could have got that you didn't?
I mean, we had at a very early stage in negotiation with Lando Norris, and in the end, we didn't get him, but yes, I think he would have fitted very well to us. But on the other hand, we can't have everybody. So we focus, and as I said, we are looking for champions. The first Grand Prix came through Vettel, the first win, yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting talking to you, because 1972 is a long time ago. That's the last time you raced competitively. But you still think like a racing driver, don't you? That's clear.
That's clear, yes.
You've never lost that.
No, and, you know, I'm always the one who is more on the aggressive side. If it comes to decision, should we go more careful? I said, no, go for it.
So look, one last driver to ask you about is Isaac Hadjar. He has made a huge impression in his first season of Formula One. I think of the podium in Zandvoort. Has he got what it takes to win championships? Are you convinced?
Yes. Simple example. Most of the circuits are new for him. And after three laps, he's competitive. And that was, I followed Michael Schumacher very closely. And also as Senna, they all had it. They didn't need 50 laps or how many tests, they come, poof, and they are there.
I feel it's all changed in 2026 for the team, isn't it? You've got the power unit coming in. We've got the new technical regulations coming in. What does success look like for Red Bull Racing in 2026? What would be enough for you?
It's the first time we are doing an engine. It was a big investment, much more than we thought in the beginning, but fortunately the company still made it possible. Of course, we are newcomers, but I think if our engine would be a front runner, it's already a big success. On the chassis side, everybody tells you that the numbers are every team. I don't hear we are behind or so. So we really have to wait to see. But if we could win with our engine in the first year, that would be unbelievable.
You've been instrumental in most of Red Bull's decisions when it comes to motorsport, right? What makes Red Bull think it can take on the likes of Ferrari, Mercedes, all these huge companies that have been making cars for decades? Tell me about that decision-making process.
I would say it's part that we're a bit crazy. And the other thing that if we decide to do something, we do it proper. And we put all the effort, all the passion behind it. And I mean, motor racing is a team sport, so you need this passion through the whole team to get successful.
Are we going to see some Red Bull road cars now on the back of what you're doing with the power unit?
You know, we have the RB17. I wouldn't say it's a road car. First of all, the price is a little bit high. And it's not really for the road. It's a track car. But that's also what we decided after the change in the management. We focus what we can, and that's racing car. No distraction. And I don't think that will come. We are having some other, we are doing a submarine, for example, but that is on a low profile.
Are you going to be in the maiden voyage of the submarine?
No.
Helmut, it's been wonderful to chat. You're 82 years old. You're still going to every single Grand Prix. Do you still love it? And how much longer are you going to keep doing it?
First of all, I love it. And if you have the passion, for me, traveling, I don't say, oh, I have to fly here and there. I'm enjoying, and I'm Mexico. Mexico is a nice country, nice food. So I always see the positive. I like it. And as long as I'm physically and mentally in a position to do my job, yes, I have a contract. First time I have a contract, I did work 19 years without a contract. It was all handshake. But since the boss died, it's becoming a little bit more a normal company, so everybody has to have a contract and so on. So that goes till 2026, and then we see.
Well, I hope you're around for many years to come. Helmut, thank you. Last thing, and this is a question I'm asking everybody on the pod this year. The sport's 75 years old in 2025. Can you give me one memory of Formula One over those 75 years that stands out? Doesn't have to involve you. It could be anything.
There are so many moments. It was Jochen Rindt in Monte Carlo who was fighting, I don't know from what position, and in the last lap, Brabham locked, went into the guardrail, and Jochen won.
Station hairpin, yeah.
Yeah. And then this multiply crash from Silverstone when Jody Scheckter took half the field out.
You remember that from 1973?
Yes, of course.
Were you there?
Yes, I was there.
In what capacity? Because you weren't racing.
I had a Formula 3 car. I was in the supporting race. Or this fight with Jochen Rindt and Jackie Stewart in Silverstone. I think they changed. They both were running in the front and the lead was changing two or three times a lap. That was fantastic moments.
Yeah. One Red Bull moment that stands out. Give us that.
Of course, the first win. First and second with Vettel and Webber.
China. 2009, yeah.
And the even more impressive thing, the first win with Max in the Honda engine on the Red Bull ring. Because that came next. After we had the teams, we have to have a racetrack as well, of course.
Helmut, thank you so much. Great to chat.
Thank you.
So many memories from Helmut. I loved this chat, and what an interesting life he's had in racing. His friendship with Rindt all those years ago, his own adversity with the loss of an eye in 1972, and then building towards world championships with Red Bull Racing. Helmut, thank you for your time. It was great to get your take on both new and old. And I look forward to seeing what Red Bull Racing can achieve in 2026 with its own power unit. Well, that's almost it for this episode. Sebastian Vettel was mentioned a few times. Big news, he's returning to F1 Beyond the Grid very soon. Make sure you're following the podcast so you get that episode as soon as it's released. While you're there, check out the latest episodes from F1 Nation and F1 Explains, F1's other official podcasts. And there's still time to get your ticket for a Grand Prix this season. Just go to tickets.formula1.com. Thank you for listening. As ever, F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There. The last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.